back on the record, Mr. Block. I don't remember where you were in...
We were on upper limits on the fund.
Nobody was listening.
Yes, they were. I'm interested in that upper limit, lower limit.
The statement that I recall you make was that you felt that the upper limit on the fund would not destroy the intent of the bill.
Well, for two reasons, or with two provisos, and that is you preserve also the ability to retroactively assess in the event of a spill, and that the assessment be based on this distribution of cost based on these underwriting considerations, so that that contingent threat, if you want to call it that, remains. And I think you would still preserve the incentive aspects of it. I think also if you're going to put on an upper limit, then you're going to need to put a lower limit, you know, beyond, below which you're going to have to assess too.
What do you feel that the kinds of considerations that you're talking about that would maintain the incentives are in the bill now, or would we have to put them in the event that a limit was put in?
No, they're in now just by virtue of the operation of the plan. In other words, since you don't have an upper or a lower limit, you're just going to start building reserves, and any time there's a spill, you're going to retroactively assess the cost of that spill. That's the way the plan is. My observation is that if you put in a top limit, then what you do is you reach this plateau of top limit, and assuming there is no spill, there is no assessment, except whatever administrative charges you're going to levy. And the problem with that is that now you're taking the incentive out because the fund itself is stabilized. And then what happens is, suppose there are a number of spills that go through the reserve but aren't sufficient to, again, activate the retroactive assessment. The fund is large enough now to absorb it. Again, the incentive is out of it. You follow me? The threat is out of it.
I think so, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, let's suppose, I'll pick numbers at random for a second here. Let's suppose you established a top limit of, say, $25 million. And over a period of 5 years or 7 years, you've made assessments and you finally reached that $25 million plateau. Now you have a $7 million spill. The argument, I suppose, is that you could take that spill out of the $25 million without retroactively assessing the oil carriers.
And is the argument that you could do that under the present language of the bill unless we do something else? Is that what you're saying?
No, under the present language of the bill, if there is that $7 million spill, we would retroactively assess the oil carrier. The state would retroactively assess them at $7 million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I'm suggesting is if you put a plateau on there, you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Let's suppose that your plateau was, say, $20 million, and you had reached $25 million over assessments. So you stop assessing. Now let's suppose you have a $7 million spill. How much do you assess? Nothing? $5 million, $2 million, or $7 million? And what you want to do, if you're going to create, you know, if you're going to try and continue the incentives, is you want to retroactively assess the full cost of that spill to hold that out as a concern to the oil companies, that contingent liability. Now, if you set the plateau, that's all right, but you want to do it in such a way that you don't render ineffective the retroactive assessment impact. If that's your objective now, I'm not advocating that, but I'm suggesting if that's your intent.
Well, I presume that one of the major objectives of the legislation is to always maintain an incentive for the industry to be using the safest equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
In that connection, we do have a specific recommendation, Dick, that says assessment of risk charges shall be suspended whenever the balance in the fund reaches $20 million, and the risk charges shall not be reimposed until such time as the balance in the fund has declined to $15 million. And from what you say, I gather that you figure that that would remove the incentive that you're talking about.
Well, it certainly would as to at least $5 million. That's correct.
As long as you didn't drop below the $15 million, you wouldn't have the incentive factor.
Well, yes, that's essentially what I'm saying.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Osterbrock.
Mr. Chairman, how far will this bill go now? If we have
unless they are ferries or fishing boats. We got fishing boats that takes 40,000 gallons of fuel, you know, and more. And they got, would it be considered a carrier when they take that amount of fuel?
My understanding is that the definitions in here, I'd have to go back and verify this, is the transporting of fuel for other than its own use. In other words, it's not carrying its own fuel, but carrying fuel for transportation from point A to B. Not my recollection of the language, but that's true.
Will this regulations, will it be in along with the Coast Guard regulations? A lot of these regulations we have in the Coast Guard right now.
Yes, sir. Of course, now we're getting out of the Coastal Protection Fund area and into the other aspects of the bill, so I'm really not the right person to testify, but from talking with others, it's my understanding that regulations would be coordinated and integrated with Coast Guard regulations, but not necessarily the same as the Coast Guard regulations.
Mr. Rowe?
This protection fund, I'm not quite clear on this. If you build it up to, say, $20 million fund, and then you have this bill, you make an assessment without paying it out of this fund. What's the fund really for, if you make assessment every time you have this bill?
Well, you'd pay it out of the fund, but you'd build the fund back up. The value of the fund, or one of the purposes of the fund, is that the money is readily available so that you don't have to. The key to this thing is to get an immediate cleanup.
Yeah, well, this is my interpretation of it.
Two inhibitions to getting it cleaned up. If you have a very major spill, I can foresee that there are two things that would inhibit an immediate cleanup. One is the exercise of deciding who should clean it up. You know, it wasn't me, it was him, and it wasn't out of my tanker, it floated from Japan, and all this kind of stuff. See? The second thing is getting the people out there, the contractors, the airplanes, and what have you, without having to, you know, worry where the money is coming from to pay it. Now this solves those two problems, because you now have a facility, a funded facility, that will make the physical tools necessary to do the job on standby and available. And secondly, you have a financially responsible entity ordering the stuff being done and getting it done immediately. Now, after the war is over and you've got it cleaned up and you now have depleted your fund, or you reduced your fund by virtue of this exercise, you now replenish it by going back and assessing to build it back up to its norm again.
Well, then I would say a top limit would be essential. Otherwise, you got just a money machine. There's no top limit on it.
I would say that's true. Top limit, I would say, is desirable, provided you build in some of these other.
All right, now who pays into this fund? Anyone that delivers oil in or out of Alaska?
The carriers pay it, and the oil terminal facilities pay it.
Have you figured out what that's going to cost? What's the impact of a gallon out in the rural communities is going to be?
No, sir, I have not.
Ever.
Has anyone done it?
Well, I can't answer that.
Mr. Osterbeck.
Mr. Chairman. Now, we're going to build up this fleet to take care of the oil. That's only for the 3-mile limit, is that right?
Well, the 3-mile limit on the coastal waters and then all of the inland waterways.
Yeah, and then tankers going across from Valdez, so. And the federal is going to put in another same kind of outfit as this to protect outside the 3-mile limit?
There already are in place a number of other mechanisms, some of which have been sponsored or created by the federal government, some of which have been created by federal law dealing with the Alaska pipeline, and some of which have been created voluntarily by the oil industry, that address the problem of oil spill cleanup outside the 3-mile limit. Well, inside and outside the 3-mile limit. So that if there were a spill outside, these other facilities would respond to that.
Seems like we're just duplicating two outfits, one inside the 3-mile limit and one on the outside, and we have to pay for both of them, both the oil companies and the citizens of the United States.
Yes, sir, you are duplicating it if all you're talking about is just a funding mechanism, because these other facilities, the Tovalop and the P&I clubs that the oil companies voluntarily participate in, and the Alyeska Fund and so forth, are just that. They are a mechanism for assuring the availability of the money. And that, of course, is a valuable thing. But the other aspects this bill accomplishes are not included in those other things. So if it's desirable to fund a ready available mechanical facility to clean up, this does that where the other funds do not. If you are trying to encourage a safer shift from the standpoint of pollution, this fund would have that impact where the others would not.
And how much would this cost to keep this outfit standing by 12 months out of the year?
Well, I don't know, but I would presume that the fiscal note encompasses that. Mr. Mueller was here and left, but it's my understanding that that would run about $1 million a year. Is that correct? I don't know.
That supposedly what comes out of the fund, I guess. Is that correct?
Yes, it's intended to come out of this fund.
Mr. Osbeck, are you done? Mr. Brown?
Getting back to this other matter of the possible limit on the fund, well, were we to put a limit of the sort suggested in the amendments that I just showed you, that are before the suggested amendments are before the committee, could you suggest to us either now or at a later time language that would accomplish what you were describing, that is some kind of a mechanism that would maintain the incentive for the operation and development of safer equipment?
Yes, sir, I could do that.
And you suggested at least one of these mechanisms might be a retroactive assessment.
Well, the retroactive assessment is in here now.
You're talking about changing it in some way.
Maybe it's because it's
Monday morning, right, and I watched the Maltese Falcon last night. I didn't track all the time when you were describing all of that. But
I watched it twice. I watched it Friday night at Taku, and I watched it last night on television. The similarities were just...
Mr. Hennigan, we've got 2 minutes before we go upstairs.
2 minutes, okay. You said in the first part of your statement that the tanker that was, let's just use the illustration as tanker that was the cause of this spill would be charged for the full bill of the spill.
No, sir. Quite the contrary. What would happen is, if there is a spill, let us assume that there is a tanker, an identifiable tanker, which spilled. What would happen is, I understand it operationally, is that this fund would go out, or that this facility would go out and either oversee or supplement the cleanup activity.
We know that. But
and let's suppose that the charge, that the cost of that runs, say, $3 million. Now, that $3 million would come out of the fund, and then the fund would charge all tankers trafficking up and down here, not just the one that did it, but all of them, on a prorated basis. And that proration would be in the way in which these assessments are to be charged, which is a function of how much oil they're carrying and a number of things, but mainly it's a function of the equipment they have on board and whether or not they have a double hull and all these other things. The ones that have them would pay less by way of retroactive assessment than would those that do not. And the tanker which caused the spill would pay an assessment, but it would be based on his characteristics of the ship and not on the fact that he spilled the oil.
Mr. Huntington?
Yeah.
We're going to have to hold this over until tomorrow for further discussion, but I'd like Mr. Block to get together with staff and yourself to address some of these questions of cost. We still don't have any idea what the cost is going to be to the consumer with the additional, with the fund and possible insurance rates and so forth. And my feeling is that I've got a great deal of concern. If you're going to increase the cost of fuel for the rural communities, you're just asking for trouble. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll hope to see you tomorrow morning. Call the meeting to order. First item on the agenda today is committee substitute for Senate Bill number 392 amended. It's an act creating an energy needs revolving loan fund and providing for an effective date. Is there anyone here to testify on the bill? Do you have it, Leo?
No, I don't.
Business.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a copy?
That's what I have.
392?
No, no, I look at a different bill.
What are you looking for? Senate Bill 392.
Go ahead and ask me a question. I found my copy.
What day is it?
When?
How much did it cost? How much is the fund?
There's no appropriation bill for this measure.
Do we have anybody here that, any of the sponsors of it can testify on it?
No, I'll, if you have any questions, you can ask me.
No loans may be made.
Well, that is what I said. Do we have any of the sponsors? Do we have any of the sponsors here?
They are in Juneau. They weren't asked to testify.
What is the certificate of need by you?
Where are you at?
44, 33, 150.
Line 12.
Line 13. Line 13, line 20. It says the department shall process and issue loans. Line 12, it says the energy office issues certificates of need.
Yeah, it goes back to the intent of the bill where small communities where they don't have access to ready fuel, where they have to transport large volumes of fuel overland. Such as, say, one of my villages, for instance.
They have to have a certificate of need before they're eligible for a loan?
Right. They would have to have demonstrate to the...
Might ought to say that somewhere then.
Doesn't it say that?
I don't think so. Can it make it?
Well, what is the intent of the bill? Can somebody tell us what it's supposed to do?
The intent of the bill is to provide a revolving loan fund for those communities where there is a need for providing fuel storage tanks in areas where there aren't those available. I was going to give an example. One is Monagudup. It's a village that's 15 miles away from Dillingham. And the way they transport their fuel is they go up a river, or else they transport through the winter across the tundra by snow machine, all the fuel by snow machine. And there isn't adequate storage facilities in the village to provide adequate storage for the entire winter. The revolving loan fund would provide money for those villages to get a loan so that they could provide their fuel storage needs for the winter. There are a lot of communities, not just in my district, but throughout the interior and western Alaska and many other places that I'm not aware of that could benefit from this this type of legislation.
Through what source of revenue would they pay it back?
The state?
The eligibility?
No, the community that borrows the money.
Yeah.
Well, the...
what source of revenue would they pay?
What they would do is, we have several villages that have non-profit cooperatives. cooperative stores. What they would do is, they'd make the loan through the cooperative, and then repay the loan through the marketing cooperative. That's the idea behind the legislation. We have several communities throughout rural Alaska where they do have co-op stores set up by CEDC that would create a marketing structure so that they would go ahead and make the loan through that nonprofit corporation, and then the entire village would repay the loans through that mechanism.
If I were in the legislature, I think this would be a tremendous project for the native corporations to take on for villages that didn't have fuel storage facilities. In fact, if I were running for president of AFM, I think I could get elected on a platform that included this.
Well,
this may be your chance.
This may be your chance,
Mike. Chairman.
Mr. Rowe.
What's the reason behind page 3, section 2? It's on line 5. After 5 years, there's no new loans made. Is there some reasoning behind it?
Well, by that time, it should be, most of the needs should have been taken care of by that time. There was seen no real reason to keep this going in perpetuity, since there probably will be no new villages or no new additional needs for the areas that are going to need these are these loans are have already been identified, and within that 5-year period, most of the needs should have been identified and taken care of with the legislation. I don't know if it would be desirable to have a bill of this nature in perpetuity.
One thing, Mr. Chairman, that makes a need for this bill is that the cost of drums in there, almost impossible to get them. See, that's the cost of a $15 deposit on drums now. It's almost impossible to get drums for store oil than it used to be. A few years back, all the storage were done in drums.
Yeah.
And the cost of shipping drums is almost twice as high as shipping fuel by barge. By bulk, I mean.
Well, if there was a loan made to a community, and the school there, which is state operated and state funded now, would they be obligated to pay? Would they be charged for that fuel storage? They would. The state would be picking up the tab, actually, on many of these because the school and the school facilities are pretty much responsible for all of the electrical generation and fuel storage and everything else. So actually the state would be picking up the tab on a lot of this through some form of rental or something, wouldn't they?
Well, there are separate fuel storage facilities in most of the villages. Most of the villages have an AVEC, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, that provides electricity for the both the villages and the schools. A lot of the villages have their own generators, and the idea again is to where you have the school providing the electrical needs for the school. A lot of the villages that don't have EVEC are not providing electricity for the village per se. But under a program like this, if the nonprofit marketing cooperative were to have available sufficient storage facilities, you could bring in more fuel at less cost to the state and to the village.
Well, could they take a loan like this and buy out
buy out AVAC and get the state out from underneath that obligation of, because we're picking up the tab, the state's picking up the tab on almost all of AVAC now.
I don't know. I sure couldn't answer that. It wasn't the intent of the legislation to do that. I think it would reduce the burden somewhat for if you did have a storage facility where you could put in the fuel in bulk at considerably less cost to the state and to the village.
Well, these would be loans into a non-profit village corporation, and they could take over the operation and of all electrical facilities in a community then, couldn't they? Not just storage facilities, they should be able to take over everything.
I don't know. That,
I don't read the bill that way.
Unless that's what you wanted for your villages that you represent, I think that would be appropriate. But I couldn't speak for the villages that may or may not wish to do what you're...
Oh, I'm just asking you, this is the reason I ask, if somebody's going to come in and tell us what the bill did, and that was the reason I was asking. Can they do these things, could a village corporation buy out the power plant, and as long as it's a non-profit corporation, they could run it probably a lot cheaper than what it's costing now, and probably be more efficient operation. And I didn't.
You take this, Jimmy.
No, it's okay. I suppose it's possible, Red. I really, you know, it would be up to the individual village.
Yeah.
I just don't see how
small villages.
You know, we could
well,
say.
Well, I think it deals only in fuel and fuel storage, I guess.
That's basically the intent of the legislation, is to provide money through a loan fund to those communities that don't have bulk storage at this time.
But it would go to a village. A village corporation would be the one, the people to.
Those who are eligible are cities, boroughs, village corporations, village councils, and nonprofit marketing cooperatives. So first class city would be eligible, borough would be eligible, village corporation would be eligible, village council, and a nonprofit cooperative.
We better do something with it because this saw the light of day Friday and it's already here. Sure is an important bill.
I'm on 75.
Hmm? Oh, 75.
It was last year.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
Just for the edification of the committee, on the history of the bill, it was replaced in state affairs with the committee substitute you have before you. Finance was 5 new passes, 1 no rec. It was amended in the Senate and passed 19-0 and transmitted to us.
This was introduced last year. It has a companion appropriations bill, but apparently that's not going to move.
Did we ask somebody from the energy office to show up? They seem to be the key agency in this thing.
No, we did not ask anyone from the energy office to show up for this bill.
I'd be opposed to acting on it without hearing something from the administration.
Okay. We'll get someone here then for this. Who would you like?
Energy office and preference.
Do you have anyone in mind?
No. Call her up.
Let's take a brief recess while they get down here.
Well, I'm swearing with my wife.
It's a matter of I'm in favor of that.
I think we ought to get this bill out today some way. You might better call her up and have a reset when she gets done.
Eliason would like that.
Where is he?
I don't know. I think he's boycotting us here. Let's see. The next bill then is committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 726, an activated exchange of land and providing for an effective date. I don't know if staff has analyzed this bill or not, but maybe you can tell us what this is supposed to be.
Mr. Chairman, about a week and a half ago, you were passed out a sheet of paper.
Whereabouts?
A sheet of papers with, if you want to search in your files, it had a orange clip on it, which included a report from the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission, and also a couple of sample bills that was passed out in front of you. They all had orange clips up on the top of them.
They lost them. I know, and they were supposed to have read them, but they never read them. I'll bet you that.
Was this last year?
And for that, you all get a slap on the hand. This all goes back to the recent administration Cook Inlet
land swap.
Land swap, right.
Oh, that was a good swap.
And
this bill.
And the Senate Resources Committee has.
I marked that down as one of my mistakes.
Come up with a bill that will clearly authorize the state of Alaska and how long exchanges shall or shall not occur. And I haven't had a chance to read the bill in its entirety, but Ted has been doing a lot of work on this and I think has probably some ideas of what he should or should not do. And the only question I have is for staff is why doesn't the mineral estate transfer?
Well, the meat of the bill is on page 3, section 38, 100-070. And that's the meat of the bill right there.
Page what?
Page 3?
Yeah, well, page 3 in this, I can't tell you what it would be, but it's section 38, 100-070.
Action by governor?
Right.
Page 4.
If the governor finds the exchange is in the best interest of the state.
I seem to recall someone
else. We should have learned by now that.
Well, that's what I.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with that, Red.
I don't either.
Still legislative approval needed.
By concurrent resolution, voice vote. Nobody's on record.
When we run this outfit, that's the way the place is going to run. What's wrong with that?
But you're not going to run it. Yeah?
As long as you're here, Red, let's tell you how.
That's right. There's 11 of you guys have bit the dust already, one a day after the 1st of May.
After 100 days, one every day. What day we on?
Well, 121 days.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hirschberger.
In reply to your comment there on the first page under section 1, reservation of mineral estate. At the bottom of that particular paragraph says the if the mineral estate is reserved to the state, the governor can make the exchange. If it is not, if the reservation of mineral estate cannot be made, you can't make the exchange. Or you can make it only in accordance with provision.
Planning Commission, and I think that their bill provides a better basis to work with than the one we got from the Senate. There's several things that are kind of confused and not clear in the Senate bill. There is some work that needs to be done on theirs, but I would hope that we could work up a committee substitute that would be based on theirs and include some of the things that are in the Senate bill that they left out and some other recommendations. I would be happy to make.
Okay.
Did everybody get one of these things, or were they?
They were distributed sometime in the past, but I don't know how many of the committee members have them. I've got mine in the other room.
Is that on D2 land?
This is in the package that the guy I was talking about was distributed earlier from the Land Use Planning Commission. I think that they're very similar in intent. The treatment of mineral lands is one, or mineral estate is one major difference. The trade of mineral estate is not prohibited in the Land Use Planning Commission version, whereas it is in the Senate's version. The treatment of the findings, I think, is much superior in the Land Use Planning Commission's version. They have a whole section on them.
Preliminary determination.
Yeah, on the finding requirement that puts out in some detail the basis upon which a determination would have to be made by the department as to desirability of the exchange. I'll read that if I may. It says, prior to circulating notice pursuant to section 38-100-110, the director shall consider other alternatives to achieve the objectives of the proposed exchange, and they shall make a finding supported by the reasons therefore that the proposed exchange will best serve the public interest. In making this determination, the director shall consider, among other things, the advantages and disadvantages of acquiring the lands or interest in land for the state by means of purchase, lease, selection pursuant to the Alaska State of the Act or condemnation. In addition, you shall consider alternatives to the disposal through exchange of state lands or interest in land, including but not limited to lease or sale. Then it's got about two pages of notice and hearing and report requirements. Report requirements include a discussion of physical characteristics of land involved, appraised fair market value of each tract, benefits and detriments which can be expected to accrue, alternatives opposed to exchange, and I think that whatever we adopt, we should have that sort of detail set out in the law to give us a better handle on the type of information, so that the information would be available in one package and comparable for any proposed exchanges.
It's something we finally arrived at in the information that we got, but it came after the fact to a large degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would favor something that was more clear on what the, say, the Division of Lands would look at before he actually made a decision, and then also have this available for the public to review.
There's also a provision for a procedure for legislative review. All in all, I think that this document does provide a much better basis for getting where we want to be than the one that we received in the Senate.
Well, do you have any suggestion on how we handle this? I would prefer not to do it in, you know, in a committee meeting, which would be a timely process, I think.
I would be happy to work with staff in preparing a draft committee substitute for 7/26.
If there's no objection to that procedure, would the committee object to having staff and Mr. Smith work this one out there and try to get a something that I feel this has some deficiencies as well. I don't think it really hits at the problem that we did have as we began to review the Cook Inlet exchange, and would prefer that we go ahead and try to put some of the good features of the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission recommendations together with the bill that the Senate has worked out. There's no objection to that, then
we can work it out. Very rapidly, copy Mark, and I think we can set down the course for an hour and get something ready to have this.
Very good, then we could probably take that first thing next week. And,
it's only Tuesday.
Well, Friday.
Thursday or Friday.
Friday. It'll be adjourned by then. There was one other concern with the with the bill. I think most of you are aware of the fact that the Yakutat community had worked out an exchange with the state, and one of the sections under which they had negotiated the terms of the exchange is going to be considered for review in the Senate version. And what the Yakutat people had asked us was to make sure that it was not the intent of the legislature to affect the recent land exchange between the state and the Act that, and if there are some ways we could protect their interests under that agreement that has already been executed between the state and the Act. So that would be one option, certainly. Okay, we'll go back to committee substitute for Senate Bill 406, the tanker facility bill. Mr. Van Dorn, do you have any new information for us? Tanker facility.
Mr. Chairman, yesterday I spent quite a few hours with the Director of Insurance, Mr. Block. We made inquiries several places in the lower 48 with insurance people, Standard Oil, and with individual terminal facility dealers as outlined in the bill. There's still much more research to be done regarding the insurance problem. Mr. Block said that he would not be prepared to offer any suggestions today, but probably would be later time this week. He's still working on it. I intend to meet with him again today. Also, the Alaska Energy Office, excuse me, please. The Alaska Energy Office called yesterday, and they've been doing some research into the insurance section of the bill, and had informed us that some of the villages are covered under the Alaska Native Industrial Corporation. They're covered by a blanket insurance policy, and they deal with a firm called Marsh & McLennan. They weren't available yesterday at the time that but the Energy Office called me. I'd like to contact them today. Also, the villages that do not come under this Alaska Native Industrial Corporation, a lot of them don't carry insurance. Some of them have tried, and the information we've received is that the normal premium is roughly 8% of the value of the installation, and normally that only covers fire insurance. It doesn't cover liability. For instance, one particular village that was mentioned had applied for this type of insurance, and it would have run them $17,000 per year for insurance of their facilities. And their conclusion, and they are going to look into it more in the Energy Office, was that most of the villages left on their own who don't become involved with the Alaska Native Industrial Corporation usually can't afford the insurance. We have also some other contacts that we'll make today. The phone call came in about 5:30 last night, and we couldn't get a hold of any of these firms. They were already closed in Seattle. So the Energy Office and myself and Mr. Block from the Insurance Division are still trying to get further information on this.
So he still hasn't worked out what the premium cost would be?
No, sir.
That's one of the things we've asked for.
Should have some information back from some of the people by tomorrow.
Yeah, we should be able to get some of the answers today, though.
I hope they'll get back with me tonight, but they might not. If I don't get back tonight,
this is your
get back tomorrow night. People in my district, They're pretty concerned, too. They're just going to lock up just half the barges and say, to hell with it.
Who would they have to?
The river barges, you mean, right?
Yeah.
Basically,
that's all the information.
Well, we'll just. I'm freezing
the dark.
Let's see, tomorrow's open, I think, right? We should be able to go tomorrow. I mean, I want Mr. Block back here tomorrow. And Bernie Mueller also. And we'll adjourn until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to give. If we can get anybody from the Energy Office for you, Ted.
They're pretty good ones. We're going to pass one out. Are we losing?